Continent of Media 0608 is on the air. Glenn Hauser here with a more or less monthly supplement to the weekly World of Radio. Continent of Media is made possible by Universal Radio in Reynoldsburg, Ohio, for quality amateur and shortwave equipment. Visit their website, www.universal-radio.com, and their other website, www.dxing.com, or phone them toll-free for a catalog, 1-800-431-3939. Continent of Media is about media around the American continent, not especially shortwave. In the CGC Communicator, July 19th, via Kevin Redding, ABDX, this item headlined Death by DMCA, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, threatens to drown whole classes of consumer electronics and will have a profound effect on the broadcast industry. Read this important opinion article in the June 2006 issue of IEEE Spectrum magazine. And here's the link. Copy carefully, www.spectrum.ieee.org/JUN06/3673. Quite a lot of this edition will be about various aspects of digital broadcasting, television, and radio. Starting with this from Bob Cooper in New Zealand via Mike Bugaj in the WTFDA. The National Telecommunications and Information Administration, NTIA, has issued a Notice of Proposed Rulemaking, NPRM, seeking comments on the program to distribute DTV adapter vouchers. Among other things, they'd like to know who should be eligible to get them. They plan to exclude any household that does not rely exclusively on off-air reception, and how to define an eligible adapter. Comments are easy to submit, email is okay, and are due by September 25th. You'll find links to the press release, FAQs, and other material at www.ntia.doc.gov. This is the complete text of the NPRM. It's not very long and is relatively easy to read if you ignore the boilerplate notices at the end. And check this Tiny Earl link, tinyurl.com/m8xk3. That provoked this comment from Guy Falsetti in Lockport, New York. I'm upset. I don't get my $40 if there is cable coverage in my area. I don't pay for my local TV stations now. Why should I have to buy access to them through the cable company? Aren't these public airwaves? The cable picture stinks. It's not anywhere near as clean and crisp as the signal from the Quantum. Right now, Western New York is in the process of switching from Adelphia to Time Warner. For the last 3 weeks, local Channel 7 has had some other audio on it. The cable company either can't figure it out or has not received enough complaints to fix it. And Channel 7 is one of my locals. That's what the consumer has to look forward to. I would suggest everyone file and complain at coupon@ntia.doc.gov or via www.regulations.gov. And then he adds the specific page where you apparently may make your comment or complaint, www.regulations.gov/FDMSPublic/component/MAIN. In case you're not clear on what in the world we're talking about, it's the digital transition coming in the U.S. in February of 2009, when everyone must convert to digital television if you're receiving it off the air. Curtis Sadowski in Illinois says, I found a website with a timeline for the DTV transition, including a reference that low-power TV transition will be dealt with after the February 17, 2009 shutoff date. He says, with all the analog full-power stations off, this could provide for years of interesting low-power TVDX reception, not to mention reception from abroad. Here's the webpage he refers to, www.benton.org/index.php?q=node/1257. By the way, if you have trouble copying these URLs, they've appeared somewhere in recent issues of DX Listening Digest, and also appear eventually on the summary for this continent of media, number 0608, via worldofradio.com. Now the radio side, let's begin with an Aibach haiku, composed by Joe Miller in Troy, Michigan, and posted on the NRCAN list. Ibiquity rules. IBOC must be heard. Does anyone care? On the IRCA list, Dan Strasberg, who I gather is a professional engineer, congratulates another of his colleagues, Barry McLarnon, on an eminently well-written and understandable piece. The best explanation of the problems with AM-band HD radio I've seen. I suspect even many of the suits in broadcast management could understand the article if they took the 10 minutes or so needed to read it. Alas, they don't want to hear the facts, so few of them will take the time to do the reading. He's referring to an article in the July 19th issue of Radio World Online by Barry McLarnon, AM Aibach Power Levels Equals Mystery. It's time to call a halt to the AM Aibach experiment and start talking alternatives. I'll read a few excerpts and then give an easy link to the entire article. The digital power level relative to the analog carrier power is fully 8 dB higher in the AM system than in the FM system, although this is not widely known. The sole purpose of complex conjugate modulation is to keep digital noise out of analog receivers tuned to the host Aibach station. The technique is not always successful, as both lab tests and practical experience in the field have shown. The real point is that it does absolutely nothing to reduce interference to stations on adjacent channels. So existing analog operations consist of the Aibach station itself, period. Another fact about AM Aibach that seems to be uncommon knowledge is that the hybrid system has two audio streams, a 20 kilobits per second core stream and a 16 kbps enhanced stream. Stereo audio is only available when the less robust enhanced stream kicks in. Talking about the digital coverage they're obtaining, AM Aibach enthusiasts invariably neglect to mention whether they're achieving stereo audio. The nature of the AM Aibach modulation virtually guarantees it will create interference to other stations. If you don't accept that, well, you're simply in denial. Applying the hybrid Aibach concept to the AM band is simply foolhardy. Amplitude modulation has no inherent protection against interference, and the band is already overcrowded with about 5,000 stations in the U.S. and Canada, shoehorned in a little more than 1 megahertz of spectrum. The channel spacing is a mere 10 kilohertz, even though stations may occupy a nominal 20 kilohertz bandwidth. Nighttime skywave propagation complicates the interference environment immensely. If anything, the band needs to be thinned out, not overlaid with digital noise generators that lay waste to defenseless analog receivers tuned to the channels adjacent to Aibach stations. USA Digital Radio dutifully developed an AM system, though one suspects without a great deal of enthusiasm. The company actually subcontracted most of the development to an aerospace firm. This was the progenitor of the Ibiquity system we have today. It seems very unlikely that on its own this system would ever have seen the light of day. It got here by riding the coattails of the FM Aibach system. The AM band becomes an adjunct to the FM band, with each AM Aibach station adding one more channel to the lineup in a digital receiver. It no longer needs to be identified with the AM band at all. No more AM stigma. And it goes on to point out the superiority of the DRM system. Well, here's the link to the entire article. tinyurl.com/H93G8. I'll give that phonetically. Hotel 93 Golf 8. Some comments from another professional radio station engineer, Craig Healy in Providence, Rhode Island. The new Wi-Fi iPod from Apple and the competing product from Microsoft are anxiously awaited by consumers and the techie media. It's not even up to the ho-hum level of excitement for any HD radio equipment. The iPods are so versatile and the HD radio does one thing, and not even all that well. Somebody said Aibach has this year to get its act together. We're halfway through and consumer acceptance is at a near dead stall. I connected my JVC HDR1 HD receiver to a good outside antenna. I cannot get any of the powerhouse New York City HD signals, yet in analog they are perfectly listenable. Even semi-local WBZ in Boston is spotty, to the point of being unlistenable consistently in HD. There are big sacrifices in coverage. Later he refers us to an August 3rd article via Yahoo News. The article outlines how most auto manufacturers are falling all over themselves to integrate iPod connectivity to their 2007 models. The article mentions the iPod, of course, and also Sirius satellite radio and other things, such as cell phones, conspicuously absent as any mention of HD radio at all. On the ABDX list, Kevin Redding in Arizona adds, I've been in need of a second car for some time. I decided to get a Saturn View. I'm pleased with it so far. It's an iHeart and Chili Pepper Red. Before I can tell you what the radio is like, I need more time to play with it. Seems okay on medium wave. It has RDS for FM and has an input for an iPod, XM, anything you want to input. But I asked the guy who sold me the car if there was an option for an HD radio. I was told there were no plans for HD in 2006 or 7. This is a GM car made by the biggest automaker in the world. He did offer me XM. What does this say for HD and IBOC? And a comment from the colorful Paul Vincent Zacchino in Florida. The feckless chamber pot of cronies, FCC, can prattle all it wishes. Interference is still illegal. If not, then every pirate broadcaster, take note. HD's license to spew RF flatulence all over the spectrum gives you an affirmative defense to the charge of causing illegal interference. There was a case years ago in which the government was held liable for defective safety broadcasts, death resulting. Sooner than later will come the day when iBlock's insolent noise denies someone vital information, resulting in injury, perhaps death. Public radio producer Stephen Hill, host of the popular electronic space music show Hearts of Space, thinks that high-definition radio is dead on arrival, and that podcasting and other internet audio options dug its grave. Hill says, HD reminds me of DCC, Digital Compact Cassette, another attempt by Mature Industry to administer life support to a sunset format. That didn't work either, and today almost no one remembers it. At his blog, Hill makes a persuasive case for the advantages of podcasting and on-demand internet radio over digital radio. He notes the typical internet audio is already higher quality than HD. There are more options on the internet, and people don't need to purchase a special $500 HD radio. Kevin Redding was quoting that from somewhere, as well as the following from Radio Inc., What's Wrong with the New Campaign for HD Radio, by Mark Ramsey. The HD Digital Radio Alliance, a joint initiative of broadcasters to accelerate the rollout of HD, has detailed its marketing strategy. Marked by the launch of Discover It, a new creative and branding initiative, the strategy includes the rollout of a new brand identity and tagline, new advertising, creative online marketing elements, and the involvement of new agency and retail partners. The initiative is part of the HD Alliance's $200 million advertising campaign announced in December. The Discover It campaign invites consumers to discover new free digital quality radio programming and new stations between the stations available with HD. It launches in 22 new markets and 28 existing HD markets for a total of 50 and can be heard in 43 of the top 50 markets. But then Mark Ramsey, who is apparently sympathetic to this, nevertheless goes on to point out the flaws in the campaign. Awareness is absolutely the wrong goal. The very terminology of the tagline, Discover It, embodies this without ambiguity. The premise is that once you discover it, you will love it. But this is dead wrong. Once you sample it, you might love it. But once you discover it, it means nothing to you. This is not a product where the benefits are intuitively obvious. It must presumably be heard to be appreciated, and the campaign on the whole misses that critical point entirely. The benefit to hearing hidden radio stations only exists if listeners are not currently satisfied with what's on the radio now. And the vast majority, he says, of listeners are satisfied. Isn't that what your ratings tell you? As for that smallish fraction that is unhappy, these are the iPod owners. My friends, they can skip your music mix and program their own. The pitch for sound quality will likewise fall on deaf ears. Sound quality is for audiophiles, not the masses. The emphasis on no monthly fees positions HD directly against satellite in the minds of the audience. This is a mistake. Satellite has 10 to 15 mega subscribers. Is that the point of comparison? Or is it the radio you and I use right now in our car, at work, and at home, and the 800 mega ones like it in the U.S. alone? Is our goal to unsell satellite or to sell HD radio? This latest effort misses the mark by a wide margin despite some terrific production value, a strong web effort, and some hard work on the part of some very talented Alliance leaders. Stephen Hill of Hearts of Space replies to this on his blog, which, by the way, is heartsofspace.typepad.com/spatialrelations/. While Mark Ramsey is critical of various aspects of HD, he's tried hard to make his criticisms constructive and not alienate colleagues. I think he's missing the core issue. The problem lies not in the details of the marketing campaign, but in the deficiency of the value proposition for listeners. Satellite has succeeded, sort of, not because they spent $200 mega on promotion, they did, or executed the rollout perfectly, they did not, but because the service itself offered listeners a better value proposition, a cable system-sized banquet of radio channels, including dozens of neglected music formats, little or no advertising, 100% coverage of areas that were underserved by terrestrial radio, and a truly national service. So the cost of the new hardware and the subscription was compensated by a strong, unambiguous value proposition. More content, desired content, uninterrupted content, national coverage. It all adds up to being worth $13 a month for many millions of people. HD radio is not a new method. It's a good old single-channel, point-to-multipoint local broadcasting in digital drag. It can barely provide time-shifting of favorite shows, much less the other listener-viewer value enhancements that are driving the internet media explosion. HD will fail to get a meaningful level of uptake, and it will waste more time and money in the process. Incumbents are stubborn that way. Broadcasters who access the situation correctly already have better places to put their development energy. I'm really sorry for the folks at Ubiquiti. They've worked long and hard, but the bar has been raised beyond the ability of conventional broadcasting to compensate. Stephen Hill concludes, HD radio is just too little and too late. You're listening to Continent of Media 0608. I'm Glenn Hauser. If you'd like to contact us, the address is WORADIO@yahoo.com or P.O. Box 1684, Enid, Oklahoma 73702, USA. Here's an interesting story. Underground radio on VLF for rescuing minors. I got a tip about this from a story originally in Spanish and Googled it up, found this at a website called news.pajamasmedia.com. Los Alamos National Laboratories announced that Vital Alert Technologies signed license agreements with the laboratory for underground radio trademark, a technology that will provide through-the-earth communications, another trademark, that is, two-way voice and text, for first responders, rescue and security teams, underground miners, and the public in critical emergency situations. Underground radio, originally developed by Los Alamos for the Department of Energy, is being commercialized by Vital Alert Technologies for use by emergency rescue crews in urban centers and by the mining industry. Joe Miller, president and CEO of Vital Alert, says it's a breakthrough in digital and wireless communications. As a pre- and post-emergency warning, evacuation, and rescue communication system, it solves radio frequency failure problems and eliminates systems' downtime complications in difficult environments such as subways, tunnels, skyscrapers, and mines. The new technology will also greatly enhance the ability of mining companies to protect their workers. Underground radio is a through-the-earth communications mechanism that offers high-level security to critical government, industrial, military, commercial, and public infrastructure. It also can be used to respond to threats of terrorism and natural disasters such as hurricanes, earthquakes, and fires. It uses very low-frequency electromagnetic radiation and digital audio compression technology to carry voice and text data. The VLF signals also can transmit tracking and location data for radio users in the case that they are unable to respond. Well, it doesn't go into much more detail, and of course I ask, WTFK, what's the frequency, Kenneth? The company website, anyway, if you want to investigate further, is www.vitalalert.com. In the DX Listing Digest Yahoo group, Aaron Dickey explains about his experiments concerning the problem of Howard Stern interfering with broadcast stations. Of course, Stern isn't at fault. We're talking about low-power transmitters in cars connecting satellite radio to radios, but which radiate far beyond the car. He says, I've done some informal tests with a Sirius unit, the StarMate R, designed to be moved back and forth from car to house, so the user does not have to pay for two separate Sirius subscriptions. There is some merit to the claims being made. In one test, I left my Sirius unit in its usual position in my bedroom, tuned to BBC World Service, so I'd be assured of an all-speech signal, but left my car radio on 93.1 FM, the frequency which I usually have the unit's transmitter set. Then I simply measured how far I could drive from my house before losing all traces of the signal. Under normal conditions and a setup where the unit's antenna is most definitely not positioned for maximum distance, I can usually get about one-fifth to a quarter of a mile from my house before the signal becomes totally unintelligible. When conditions were a bit more optimal, it got better than one-third of a mile. The signal is somewhat directional, but it definitely carries surprisingly far, no matter which side of the house I'm measuring from. As I come home on a nearby one-way road, I can pick up the signal weakly as I pass my house's position. In the other test, I drove around town in areas of heavy traffic during rush hour and flipped around amongst the frequencies from 87.7 to 88.7. Most subscribers to XM and Sirius don't do anything except turn their units on and leave them set to the first frequency that the unit offers, which their car radio can also receive, which means the vast majority of them are at 87.7, 87.9, or 88.1 at worst. In my town, we have a college station on 88.1 with a very close transmitter site, so I figured that there'd be a lot of users here that bumped their units' transmitters to 88.3 or 7. But to my surprise, there were a lot of people who kept their transmitters smack on 88.1. That was my first indication that not too many people were suffering from weak transmitters in their units. As I drove around, I picked up plenty of transmissions from other people's cars, and usually we would have to get at least 3 to 5 car lengths apart before I'd lose the signal. Of those people who had Sirius units instead of XM, well over half of them were indeed listening to one of Howard Stern's two channels. And XM owners were listening to Shock Jocks Opie and Anthony. Even when the transmitters were on 88.1 and the local station was on the air, they tended to overwhelm the local station for about 2 car lengths. I definitely noticed that Sirius units tended to have stronger transmitters than XM. I've seen discussions on satellite radio boards about this. Apparently there's something about the design of XM units that are somehow supposed to piggyback onto a car's own antenna system, whereas with Sirius units, it's merely a matter of brute force transmission. I can only offer conjecture as to the whys and hows of the sudden increase in media coverage of this issue. My guess is it's simply a matter of the huge explosion in the number of such transmitters over the past sesquiyear, combined with the fact that religious stations tend to be located down at the left end of the dial. Regardless of what Howard Stern might be discussing at any given moment, and whether or not that might include profanities, I don't think there's much question that if a given driver is expecting to hear a sermon and instead gets Stern mentioning much of anything, the driver is going to blow a gasket and start complaining about it to anyone he can think of. Those who keep up with FCC actions have noticed that a number of Hawaiian AM stations have been changing frequency and making other technical changes. But why? It seems this has something to do with what's going on in California, 4 megameters away. Why should 2 locations so far apart influence each other as far as co-channel interference? For DXers, yes. For ordinary listeners, no. Would any other pair of entities, even over water, have to coordinate their medium wave bands so closely? California stations are commonly heard in Hawaii, but the reverse is hardly true, and California is where all the population and influence are. Nevertheless, little Hawaiian stations are protected from mainland co-channel interference. Ben Dawson, another professional engineer in Washington State, replies, "The U.S. used to ignore interference questions between Hawaii and the mainland until the adoption of rule changes in Docket 87-267. Those eliminated the exception. And because those changes adopted the modified skywave calculation procedure developed by John Wang for all cases of interference calculation to U.S. stations domestically, they result in other anomalies. If you calculate interference to U.S. stations along the East Coast, it's not uncommon for Venezuelan and Colombian stations to be part of the interference calculation. And in the West, the nighttime interference-free 25% RSS calculation to stations as far north as Seattle and Kalispell includes stations from mainland South America as far south as Chile. All of this comes about because Wang's method does not properly evaluate the double-hop situation for distances greater than 3,200 kilometers, and is inaccurate, in my opinion, for cases where one terminal of the path is below 20 degrees north latitude, or particularly where trans-equatorial paths are concerned. For North America itself, north of 20 or 30 degrees, it is a very accurate and valid method, but should not have been extrapolated to the entire region to area, and the Hawaii protection requirement is a giant problem for facilities improvement for many West Coast stations. Here's an interesting frequency to monitor from Alaska, especially as we get into winter. It was posted by someone using the name Atu Bosch in Alaska on the UDXIF list. It's about 3230 kilohertz, the call sign WNJI929, heard at 1800 UT SSB, July 23rd. Many HF stations throughout remote areas of Alaska are using this same call sign, Whiskey November Juliet India 929. Most of these camps are transient, often staffed by biologists, law enforcement, geologists, support crews, etc. Communications doctrine was very confusing at first when I tuned across the net, with many using the same call sign. They are using their location as the actual ident, such as Clear Creek or Sparse Ridge. Plenty of casual net chatter and personal discussion. Other listed frequencies for this activity are 4461, 4561, and 5196 kilohertz. 3230 is the main channel for these remote camps. And so we arrive at the conclusion of Continent of Media 0608, derived from material in DX Listening Digest via worldofradio.com. Glenn Hauser here, hoping you've enjoyed it. This program also known later as World of Radio Extra 72.